Good morning from the Carver Center for Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, September 29th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. The annual Susan G. Komen Pink Ribbon Luncheon will be held Thursday, October 3rd from 11:30 a.m. until 1 p.m. at the Northwest Arkansas Convention Center in Springdale. Proceeds from this luncheon and silent auction will benefit Komen Ozark. Tickets and more information available at KomenOzark.org or 750-PINK.
Ahead on Weekend Ozarks, a tour of historic Cane Hill. The small town has 16 nationally registered historic properties.
And a conversation with the author of Camp 9, Vivian Schiffer. The book has been selected as the 2013 If All Arkansas Read the Same Book book.
But first, one, two, three, four. Lots of news about numbers this week. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more in this week's Week in Review.
Stories we bring you during our daily newscast on Ozarks frequently have something to do with the numbers. For instance, one story we brought you this week involved some troubling statistics. The recently released 2012 American Community Survey by the U.S. Census Bureau shows that Arkansas's poverty level for the year was at 19.8%, slightly higher than during the previous year. Rich Huddleston is the director of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. While he says that one in five Arkansans are living in poverty, likely as a result of continuing recovery from the economic recession, Arkansas's poverty levels are similar to the state's southern neighbors, who have historically also had high poverty rates.
I think for me, what is most troubling about the new poverty numbers is that it shows that nearly 29% of children living in poverty. And of course, I think everybody's by now very well aware of all the research that's been conducted over the years that really shows that when children, especially young children, grow up in poverty, they're much more likely to be at risk of a lot of negative outcomes that can impact their ability to develop and succeed, and also how they do later in life.
He says that two short-term measures that could help alleviate the state's high poverty rates would be implementation of the Affordable Care Act and the private option in Arkansas, which would help ensure those living in poverty and provide a safety net for future income, and the passage of a federal nutrition bill, known as food stamps or SNAP, to provide adequate nutrition assistance for those living on low incomes. But numbers can also be good news, particularly when they deal with time estimates on construction projects, like the story we ran about construction of the 71B flyover moving forward in North Fayetteville. Over the course of the past month, crews have completed installation of the steel beams that form the underlying support structure of the $6.3 million flyover bridge. Chris Brown, Fayetteville city engineer, says that the contractor of the project, Emery Sapp & Sons of Columbia, Missouri, has progressed at a pace quicker than was originally expected.
Their original schedule that they submitted showed them to be planning to be completed in May of next year, and they are right now a little bit ahead of that schedule even. The weather as we move into the fall will start to get more iffy, obviously, so they have to get good weather to continue on this pace. But right now, yes, they certainly are ahead of schedule and have done really well in progressing on the project.
Brown says that moving into autumn, the project can stay ahead of schedule depending on what the weather has in store.
Really what it amounts to is the concrete placement. We can't place concrete in freezing temperatures, and we have to have usually up to about a month of good weather after the concrete is poured so it cures properly. They can protect it and they can do some other things in colder weather, but if we get really cold, extreme temperatures, then they're not going to be able to pour that concrete deck, and that essentially will shut them down until spring. So that's really kind of what we're battling as we move on into the fall and winter months.
The flyover bridge was originally expected to open to traffic in June of 2014, but Brown says that if the weather holds out and construction keeps its current pace, the bridge could conceivably open a few months ahead of the contractor's estimated May completion date. But stories about construction or development projects don't always deal with numbers as they relate to time estimates. Sometimes they deal with water levels. This week, work will progress on development of the watershed sanctuary at Lake Keith in Cave Springs. Draining of the lake will begin Monday, during which Delia Hawk, director of the Illinois River Watershed Partnership, says that water levels will increase downstream as the lake flows under the Highway 112 bridge.
What the calculations are is that there'll be a slight rise in the water level, but nothing more than, say, we get in a normal rain event. And the reason for that is there's only so much of a hole, you know, that the water can go through underneath the highway over onto the other side. So in some ways it will have its own control mechanism for the size or the amount of water that can go through at any one time.
Another story making headlines this week was the political standoff in Washington, seemingly centered on the issue of money, as Republicans threatened a government shutdown if the Affordable Care Act wasn't defunded. But the issue was divisive, even among conservatives. Media reports of a heated discussion in the Senate Republican Conference between Senator John Bozeman of Arkansas and Ted Cruz of Texas underscores a growing disagreement in the party over how to tackle the Affordable Care Act. Some in the GOP want to amend the law, while others are willing to defund it, even if that means shutting down the government. Senator Bozeman says that action must be taken to repair the law because, in its current form, it is unaffordable.
The problem is, for those of us that oppose Obamacare, the votes simply aren't there in the Senate to actually derail it. So we'll have to wait and see, but I think at the end of the day, it will go back to the House, and then they'll have to decide whether or not to go ahead and pass it as it is or to amend it.
According to the news site Politico, the normally mild-mannered Senator Bozeman stood up to Senator Cruz and expressed frustration over the tension caused by the congressional standoff over defunding the health care law. According to the article, Bozeman told Cruz that he, quote, hasn't been bullied since the seventh grade, and he wouldn't be bullied now, end quote. But that didn't prevent Senator Bozeman from voting against a continuing resolution Friday afternoon that would keep the federal government functioning past the Monday night deadline and keep funding for the Affordable Care Act intact. And finally, another story that is almost entirely about the numbers, particularly because it deals with test scores. Students in Arkansas are improving their performance on advanced placement tests, according to information by the College Board, the national organization responsible for advanced placement, SAT, and ACT testing. State education officials report the number of students taking advanced placement exams is up by 6.6%, and students' test scores were also up in 2013. Mary Catherine Stein oversees AP programs for the state's education department.
The last few years, our participation rates have gone up each year, and also the number of students making qualifying scores at 3, 4, and 5 have increased. Because the state has invested in paying for the exams and invested in a lot of teacher training in advanced placement and pre-AP teaching, we've had remarkable results from students.
According to the College Board, the most popular AP exams in Arkansas in 2013 were English language, English literature, U.S. history, world history, and calculus. State education officials also note that every high school in the state offers students a minimum of 4 AP classes in the core areas of English, social studies, math, and science. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
The latest census count claims around 800 people live in Cane Hill, a small town in western Washington County. In the mid-1800s, Cane Hill and Fayetteville, with a current population of over 70,000, were around the same size. Many in the area are familiar with the Cane Hill College Building, or the old metal mill wheel. In addition, many other historic buildings and landmarks are in various stages of disrepair. There have been many mostly unsuccessful efforts to save them, but thanks to an anonymous benefactor, a new foundation has developed, and the 501c3, Historic Cane Hill, has been formed. Many of the buildings and landmarks have been acquired by the organization, and Bobby Brawley, originally from Lincoln and a recent PhD graduate from the University of Tennessee, has been hired to lead these new efforts.
The main thing is they knew that it's going to take somebody local. Cane Hill is a very tight-knit community, and it's important to know that somebody local is going to be looking out for their best interest and taking care of some of these properties down here. And that's really, I think, one of the reasons that it historic preservation hasn't been as successful down here as it could be, because they really want somebody that's local to be taking care of their history. And so I was excited to be coming back. I love Knoxville, but the opportunity to come back home was just too good to turn down.
Bobby's background is in anthropology and historic restoration. And today, he takes us on a tour of historic Cane Hill.
We're headed south along Arkansas Highway 45, which was really the main street that went through Cane Hill and was originally a dirt road, obviously. In turn of the century photographs, you can see quite a bit of activity starting about right through here with 6 to 8 shops along both sides of the highway. And now these are about the only three that are left, and both of the two of the three are much later.
Cane Hill is focused in an 8 to 9 mile valley along Highway 45, which runs from central Arkansas through Fort Smith and northward onto Fayetteville and beyond. The 16 to 18 nationally registered historic properties are relatively spread out, and the tour we take today is something that Bobby would like to recreate for visitors, as the traditional museum model just won't work here.
I would like to see all of them linked up together with some sort of either driving trail, or my ideal thing would be to see a nice walking, running, biking trail that you could see a lot of these different properties from. After we've done some great historical research, some archaeology, you can generate some nice sign panels, information panels along that trail that describes each of the properties in detail.
Bobby hopes to have markers in place as early as this spring. As he talks, he stands next to the Pyatt Moore Mill Wheel. Cane Hill was settled in 1827, and many mills were built shortly thereafter to mill flour, corn, and to saw logs. Attached to the rock walls of what is left of a small building, the large metal wheel hangs into Jordan Creek. It is covered in graffiti and very bent out of shape. While this property is owned by a separate nonprofit, Historic Cane Hill hopes to reach out to them and work together to restore what is left.
One of the things the National Register of Historic Places nomination talks about, a lot of the different buildings throughout Cane Hill, they're built sort of in a vernacular architecture, so they're constructed using a lot of native stone. A lot of the sandstone obviously all came from right here. Even when we get up later to the Methodist Manse building, that was made with bricks that were made right here in Cane Hill with locally available clays. And it's one of the only brick buildings at that time that was ever constructed in very early architecture.
Though that brick has been painted over, the irregular shapes from the hands that formed the local clay 179 years ago in 1834 can be seen. The Federal-style architecture is quite basic and symmetrical. Though the brush has been cleared away, the roof is sagging, and inside, the floor is caving in. Though the town was settled by Presbyterians, there were quite a few Methodists, and this was their church. As the congregation grew, they built a wooden structure, and this became the manse, where the preacher lived.
The most interesting thing about it, and the coolest thing about the association in addition to the architecture, is that this was the Union headquarters during the Civil War. So they used part of it. We know that it was definitely the headquarters. They may have used part of it as a hospital, but they also certainly used one of the buildings up on the college campus for also a Union hospital. So those were some of the only two buildings to survive during the war because they were Union occupied. The Union burned most of the other buildings. So I think this one really has a lot of history.
During the Battle of Cane Hill, most of the buildings in town were burnt down, and the current college building was actually built in 1886. Cane Hill was the first college of higher education in the state of Arkansas, founded in 1834. In 1852, it became the first institution to grant four-year degrees, and in 1875, the first in the state to admit women. The University of Arkansas in Fayetteville became the land-grant institution in the state, and eventually the college became the town's high school and was up and running as such until the town consolidated with Lincoln in 1956.
The building that we're in, by 1858, the college had four buildings, pretty large buildings, which is pretty incredible to think about this little town. But at that time, the population was probably about the same size as Fayetteville. Fayetteville continues to get larger, Cane Hill stays about the same, and then eventually starts to decline.
The end of college education in Cane Hill came in 1891. The building is in okay shape, but cracks in the wall along the stairway are clues to structural damage. As with many old schoolhouses, the bell tower on the lawn is a symbol for the town. The bell has been through many iterations, being recast and even stolen for fraternity pranks.
Thank you.
As we leave the college and travel north, Bobby takes me by the town's active cemetery on the way to a very unactive cemetery. I was a little concerned as to where we were headed as Bobby turned off the highway and into a pasture, his SUV taking us uphill on property his family actually once owned. The plot has had various names, but is most commonly referred to as the Bing Carnahan Cemetery.
This is one of the few places I've ever seen where it's so early. These folks were actually Revolutionary War veterans, so these two here. And this is John Carnahan and Jacob Pyatt. These are some of the two founding fathers of Cane Hill. And again, you can see why they chose this spot. Amazing, amazing view up here. It's really nice. Got a great breeze. John Carnahan was born 1756, died in 1840. Jacob Pyatt, born 1780, died 1844. So incredibly early cemetery for this area to have Revolutionary War veterans interred in it. And again, they're some of the founding fathers of Cane Hill.
This property is also owned by the 501c3 Historic Cane Hill. And there are plans to place stone pillars on the corners and a split rail fence around this burial site. Bobby's organization is housed in the 6-bedroom John Edmonston House. Built in 1896, it is also on the list of National Historic Properties. The hope and confidence to restore these properties is evident, and the dream to share the stories of Cane Hill's past is strong. To follow the progress, search Facebook for Historic Cane Hill. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
Later today on This American Life, a police officer, Adrian Schoolcraft, decides that he's going to wear a secret tape recorder on the job. He records roll calls where cops are told that their boss wanted more tickets issued, or they'd be disciplined.
He wants at least 3 seatbelts, 1 cell phone.
Adrian Schoolcraft also records police being told not to file reports on the worst crimes to help their numbers. But then, the police go after Adrian Schoolcraft. Later today.
This American Life, just ahead this morning at 10 o'clock here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This week, the Arkansas Center for the Book announced the 2013 selection for its If All Arkansas Read the Same Book program. The book is the novel Camp Nine, written by Vivian Schiffer and published by the University of Arkansas Press. The program encourages Arkansans to read the same book and then participate in discussions about it during the month of October. Camp Nine is a novel set at a Japanese internment camp in Rohrer, Arkansas during World War II and was inspired by real events. In May 2012, Vivian Schiffer came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to me about the then recently published book. I asked her about the inspiration for the novel.
To me, the beauty of fiction is that it allows you to take fact and pull from the fact what you think tells the truth, and then create a story around that. And I think there are a number of books about the Japanese-American incarceration experience that are very good, and they're very informative, and they're very well written. No one will ever read them because they're not interesting, because they're not story. They're nonfiction. And so to me, it was an opportunity to take people somewhere. Most of the readers of Camp Nine have never been to the Arkansas Delta. And to me, that's such an interesting place. It's the most underappreciated corner of the most underappreciated state, in my opinion. And I wanted to take people there.
And you do. You take us to the internment camp. You take us along the levee when
right.
Jess's grandfather is driving along. There is a very much a sense of place in Camp Nine.
Thank
not,
you.
Not just in Camp Nine, but of the town that you've created and was inspired by your childhood home.
Right. And I had read Jimmy Carter's autobiography, his memoir, once. And he's far older than I am. And he was writing about a time far more distant when he was a little boy growing up in the Depression. And I read that and I was so taken there by what he wrote. And I marveled at it. And I wondered how he could remember all of that. And when I began writing this, all of those memories came back. It really surprised me. I can see it. In fact, I don't even know now what's real and what I made up.
Really? Yeah.
When I see my childhood in my imagination now, I really do have to wonder how much of it I conjured up, because I really did put myself in that place so much when I was writing.
You had to create a place, though, that was older. I mean, you did not grow up in Rook in the 1940s,
That's correct.
So you had to Do you think there was much difference in roar in 1945 and then when you grew up?
It was bigger.
In 45.
In 1945. Right. It was bigger. It was I didn't do a great deal of research for concentrated research for the book, or I should say directed research for the book. I have since done far more research because I'm also making a documentary about the Japanese-American incarceration experience in Arkansas. But what has surprised me is I was talking to a local historian in Deschutes County who showed me a plat of Roar, Arkansas, from around the 1940s. And it showed all of the houses and the businesses. And there was so much more there than there was in the 1960s when I was living there. It had really started to die as people moved, because people back then didn't have the transportation they do now. So if they worked on farms or the river or whatever industries there were there, they would live in these small towns. Now the opportunity is to live in McGee or live in Dumas, mm-hmm. Or Greenville, Mississippi, and then commute to your job at Potlatch. Or it's not Potlatch anymore. I forget the name of the paper mill now. But more people lived, I think, in small towns then. So having said that, though, I think it was still very similar in the early 1960s to the way it was in the 1940s. I remember that my grandparents didn't have a phone. They came to use our phone.
And you point out in the book that's set in – most of it's bookended by times in 1965. But in the 40s, the highways were not good.
That's right.
A lot of people didn't have cars. So you just didn't get much beyond the county.
And there was rationing, gas rationing as well. So mm-hmm. people really couldn't go. I did fudge one fact, I'll confess.
It is a novel.
It is a novel.
After all.
Highway 1, which really does exist, was not paved during World War II. And I did not make that. In my mind, it was paved in the 1940s, and so sue me.
Did you know much about Roar's history when you were growing up?
No, I didn't. For one thing, it wasn't so remote as to really seem like history, I think. Mm-hmm. And I wonder sometimes why people didn't discuss it or talk about it or try to preserve the sites. And then I realized I was born only 15 years after the war ended. So it really probably seemed to the people there that they were just moving on with their lives. They were just happy it was over and moving on. So it really wasn't much later until people started preservation efforts and people began to talk about what had happened. And, of course, my mother was central to that dialogue and to the preservation efforts. But I think that was part of it, was that it wasn't enough time that people really thought of it as something historically significant. But to me it was, because when you grow up in a town that small, you get the sense, I did at least, that it's nowhere. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why it was chosen as the site for an incarceration camp, is it really was nowhere. And so it was a great place to park almost 10,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry in a place where nobody was going to find them.
Well, you write in the novel that as quickly as it went up, it came down.
That's
was that
right.
the case?
That is correct. It's my understanding that there was an auction. As soon as the camp closed, there was an auction, and every bit of furniture, china, cutlery, anything that it takes to sustain 8,500 people on a day-to-day basis was sold away. And those barracks where they lived were carted off, and many of them were used in the area for people to live in or farm buildings. And there still are some surviving buildings in the McGee area. You can't tell by looking at them. They've been remodeled, but they are underneath barracks from the incarceration camp.
One of the characters in this book who is in the internment camp, David.
Yes.
Sneaks out. He has because he works for a person in town, he's given a pass. But he eventually starts getting out and learns at the foot of a legend. Someone who doesn't know a legend, the
right.
blues. Do you know if there was much interaction between people in the internment camp and people in the town?
There was a fair amount, more than people think. That's what surprised me. People in the camps did have some ability to leave. Of course, they didn't have a lot of transportation. It wasn't like they could bring their cars. But there were organized efforts to take them into McGee shopping. In fact, I found a letter in the papers of Homer Adkins, who was then the governor of Arkansas. Those are at the Arkansas History Commission in Little Rock. And there was a letter from a resident of McGee, who's been dead now for many years, but I knew of his family, complaining that the Japanese should not be allowed to come into McGee because they looked like they were having too much fun and they wouldn't speak English. Mm-hmm. So obviously he was talking about the Issei, the first generation, many of whom didn't speak English. And so they did curtail their movements a little bit after local complaints. Of course, they didn't cause any trouble. It was just sort of a public relations problem. But the whole thing, if I could digress here for a moment, sure. Because you've asked about Willie, I don't know that there was any interaction between the Japanese Americans and the African Americans. And in making this documentary, I've asked that question of the few survivors I've been able to find. Because remember, this happened so long ago that people who were old enough to remember have largely passed away. So I've asked the question because I was curious. People, Japanese Americans from the West Coast during that time, having grown up in the Depression, wondering if they'd had any interaction with African Americans. That was the culture clash I was most interested in. And they didn't really have much interaction with African Americans. And that became part of the book, was that it was acceptable for Caucasians to interact with the Japanese Americans and for Caucasians to interact with African Americans, but the two minority groups were not really supposed to come in contact. And I don't think they had much opportunity mm-hmm. to. But I created the Willie character because the history of Deschutes County and the history of the Delta, to me, has not been celebrated. And I was a child of the 60s. So when I was listening, it always fascinated me after I grew up and realized the irony. When I was listening to the radio and I was dreaming, I was listening to Eric Clapton dreaming about being in England. He was in England dreaming about being in the Delta because that's where his music came from. And as a child, we didn't have any sense. I certainly didn't have any sense that the music of the Delta shaped the British invasion.
Rolling Stones, the Beatles.
Absolutely. Led Zeppelin, my favorite group. Some of their songs were Delta blues mm-hmm. songs. So that I needed to write that in there. I needed to add that as a dimension because to me that's just so important to the history of the Delta.
I want to ask you about my favorite scene in the book, and that's when Chess, her mother, is now teaching an art class inside Camp 9, and so she's become a frequent visitor to Camp 9. And at one point, she goes outside. And we, the reader, don't realize what's happening when it's happening, but she's helping make something.
Right.
As she's asking questions, trying, because she's a very curious child. And when it's all done, she finds out, oh, it's a monument in the making. It's a beautiful scene.
Thank you.
And it's very subtle. Tell me about writing that scene. Did you know that scene was going to be part of the book?
No. Early?
No?
I didn't. For your listeners who don't know, and I encourage them to look into it if they have the opportunity. One of the things that's unique about the Arkansas, about the Roar camp, there were two, first of all, let me back up, there were two camps in Arkansas. There was one at Jerome and there was one at Roar. Nothing remains of the Jerome camp other than a smokestack. There were 10 incarceration camps under the direction of the War Relocation Authority. Of those 10 camps, the only one that has anything like what's at Roar is Roar. And what's there is a cemetery. And it's really, really beautiful. And it's so striking because it's out in the middle of what's now bean fields, cotton fields. And it has two monuments that were from the time that were built by the residents themselves. And they're absolutely stunning. One is shaped like a tank and one is an obelisk with an eagle on the top. And they were fascinating to me as a child because I would never have dreamed that outsiders would have visited Roar, Arkansas. And yet here were Japanese characters on this monument. To me it was as if they had come down in spaceships and landed and then been whisked away. But that cemetery to me was central to the story. And when I first started writing the book, I didn't know it was going to be its own character, but it's ended up anchoring it. I'm not sure why Roar has that, and none of the others have it. And in research for the film, I've tried to find out. I know it was built by the residents. I know it was built by the USO. They had a strong USO community. But I still can't find why, what possessed them to make these monuments. And so I have a story in Camp 9 about how it came to be, which is, of course, fiction.
Right.
But that story just came out. I didn't plan. I didn't sit down and plot it out and plan it and think, okay, I need to have a reason why there's a cemetery there. But and Mr. Hayashida, who is the sort of the wizard of the story, if you follow, you know, the story of myth, mm-hmm. How the characters sort of follow mythological characters, he's the wizard. And so he had to be the one who built it.
Another character, Henry, fights for the United States. And you know, in this book, question, here are people, American citizens, who were rounded up quickly, taken away from their homes, had their homes taken away. Yet then, many of the young men were expected to fight for the very country that had taken away their families' homes.
That's right. And it's there are two, I think, very fascinating stories that hinge on that point. The first is that the 442nd, which is the Gopher Broke Battalion, the most highly decorated United States military unit in U.S. military history of all time, was composed entirely of Japanese-American soldiers, most of whom were from the mainland, but many were from Hawaii. Senator Inouye, Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, was famously of that group and lost his arm fighting. They were an extraordinary – their story in itself is extraordinary. The other story that I found surprising and is less well known is the resistance to joining the 442nd. And part of what's interesting about that is that when this incarceration experience was cooked up, was hatched up, it was in response to hysteria. And it was in response to racism and business interests. As soon as it was undertaken, it became somewhat of a publicity disaster. So what I've uncovered in my research, what I've learned in my research, is that the United States government then had to do an about-face and try to turn it into a publicity plus. So they carefully crafted an image of the Japanese Americans as 100% loyal and willing to do whatever it took to win the war, which in large part was true. And if they had just left these poor people alone and let them live their lives like everybody else, it would have been absolutely true. But because of what had happened to them, many in the community resisted. And that history of resistance was not well documented. The government propaganda machine jumped into full force, and you see these newsreels about smiling Japanese Americans cheerfully going off to join the war and cheerfully going off to the workforce. And those were all true, although the images were orchestrated. But then there were a lot of people who didn't agree with it and were angry and bitter. And I hope that's part of Camp 9 as well. But it was not uniform. And I'm happy now that that story is also coming out, that the 442nd was incredible and it was an heroic response to this injustice. But there were also people who resisted that, and even in the camps there were young men who resisted going.
Vivian Schiffer is the author of the novel Camp 9. It was published in 2011 by the University of Arkansas Press, and this week was announced as the Arkansas Center for the Book selection of If All Arkansas Read the Same Book. She will discuss the book at three area libraries in early October, at the Fort Smith Public Library at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, October 8th, then at the Van Buren Public Library Wednesday morning, October 9th at 10 a.m., and at the Springdale Public Library again on Wednesday, October 9th at 2 p.m. The library events are free and open to the public. The conversation we heard first aired on Ozarks at Large in May 2012.
Well, for this week's Sunday morning montage, it occurred to me that it's the last day of September, or the last Sunday in September. Not
right.
Tomorrow's the last day.
Yeah, but September's almost gone.
And for me, October, really, that's when fall really hits.
Agreed. I mean, there are all the little markers, but not even our friend Antoinette Grajeda, who loves summer, can deny that once October 1st is here, that summer is over.
Right. Summer's over.
Right.
Well, and so I decided to kind of say farewell to summer.
And
with
you did that with a montage about?
Goodbyes.
So long, farewell. I'll be to say adieu.
Adieu, adieu. To you and you and you.
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Oh, no. You say goodbye. And I say hello.
Hello, goodbye. Hello, goodbye.
Hello, goodbye. Why you say goodbye? I say hello.
This is it.
Yeah. I guess so.
This is harder than I thought it would be.
No, it's gonna be okay. Okay.
Lloyd.
Shh. Just go ahead.
What about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night.
When I said I would never leave you.
And you never will. I've got a job to do, too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of.
And a privilege to come into your homes all these years and entertain you. And I hope when I find something that I want to do and I think you will like and come back, that you'll be as gracious inviting me into your home as you have been. I bid you a very heartfelt good night.
Speaking of goodbyes, we also have to mention that one of the longest-tenured KUAF folks is leaving after tomorrow.
Right. Doyle Garner is our engineer here. So he works on the tower. He works on all of our sound equipment and so much more that I don't even understand.
No, we don't know what he's doing.
I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know. But he's doing it. So and tomorrow is his last day. So a goodbye to Doyle as well.
That's right. And today was the last day, or will be the last day, that Mariano Rivera pitches for the New York Yankees.
Okay, well.
So a lot of goodbyes.
A lot of goodbyes. To see how you did on our Sunday morning montage of goodbyes, go to our website, OzarksAtLarge.com.
Good morning. It is Sunday, September 29th, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Many things will be mispronounced in this segment.
Disclaimer. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Or just not pronounced at all, because this is a story about a little boy who grew up in Bhutan, which, if you need to know, is bordered by India on the south and Tibet on the north.
Yes.
And entered the monastery when he was nine.
All right.
And then somehow wound up in Fayetteville trying to raise money to rebuild the monastery, which was taken down to the foundation in a fire last summer.
Tell me more.
His name is Tinley Ropke, and you'll hear him around here referred as Lama Tinley, because he is a teacher. Apparently, most families in his childhood village sent at least a child to the monastery, but it wasn't necessarily the child's choice.
Right.
He asked to go when he was eight.
So he, okay.
If he had stayed in Bhutan, he would be in what is called life retreat, which means living alone somewhere secluded. His students would come to him there. He would never leave. Unless another teacher needed him enough to ask him to come. Instead, he's living in Northwest Arkansas. He's meditating, teaching, working as a carpenter, owns a shop. But he still has these ties to Bhutan.
Understandably.
And he wants to raise money to rebuild. And here's where the mispronunciation happened. The Wangdu Fodrang Dzong, which is the monastery he was a little boy in.
And that was engulfed in flames.
It was built in 1638 by the founder of Bhutan.
Oh, my.
It was repaired in 1837 after a fire, and in 1897 after an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the big fire last summer. Lama Tinley says that it's a loss not just for him or for his country, but for the world, because it played a significant role in the advancement of a particular sect of Buddhism, which ultimately became the state religion of Bhutan. So, there you go.
And the fundraiser
here? There is a fundraiser going on. It includes all kinds of food from the kitchens of the Himalayas and Twin Kitchen Thai and music by Shoren Cockrum and Donovan, Rachel, and Anne, a slideshow about Bhutan and a silent auction. And all of this happens at 6 o'clock Friday. Where else would it happen in Fayetteville?
I'm going to guess St. Paul's.
Good guess. Because Father Lowell has an open door for everybody. It happens at Parish Hall, and tickets are $20 for adults, $35 for couples, and $12 for students and youth young, older than six. And you can get them at the Himalayan Mountain Shop on Block Avenue in Fayetteville or by calling 530-2574. Lama Tinley will deliver the proceeds in person in February.
That's a great story.
Kind of fun.
Yeah.
Also this afternoon, City Lights.
Oh, yes.
The Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra, led by Stephen Bias, accompanying the silent film City Lights at 2 o'clock at the Arend Arts Center.
This doesn't happen that often.
No.
I mean, Frank Scheid, who knows all about Chaplin, I've had a conversation with him in the last couple of months. He said, no, this just does not happen that often.
And this is the same weekend as the Buster Keaton
in Kansas?
Thing in Iola, Kansas, which is where I'm from, because Buster Keaton was born in Pickway, Kansas, on his way to a vaudeville show.
That's right. Well, so, on his parents' way to a...
Well, he was on his way,
well,
to...
That's, yes, absolutely.
Anyway, this afternoon's performance is at 2, and tickets are $5 to $25. You should make reservations by calling 841-4644. The last performance of The Wizard of Oz is this afternoon at Rogers Little Theater at 2 o'clock.
And check at their website. They have these things called rush tickets that they're kind of releasing just before, because the demand for this show has been
insane.
Yes.
Well, it's not often you get flying monkeys and flying witches.
I think that's a fair
and,
thing to say.
Yeah,
right.
All of this in Northwest
Arkansas.
A melting witch.
Spoiler alert, yes.
Yes. So check this out. Check out their website or call 631-8988. Last performance of Cinderella at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale.
Wow.
Remember, that happens at 3 o'clock
right.
at ACO. And the All You Need to Know show.
That's tonight.
Yes, at 7 o'clock at Maxine's Tap Room in Fayetteville. Of course, has to do with Erica Wilhite and Morgan Hicks, who make interesting things happen.
And what they do is they have a word that has been picked at random, and then they invite area poets and singers and performers to riff on that word. And the word tonight
is bicycle.
Yeah.
So
if you're not too tired, you can go.
Oh, I'm going now.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Becca Martin Brown, his features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On the next Celtic Connections, we feature songs written by Richard Thompson, as covered by the likes of Bohola, Open the Door for Three, Tea with the Maggies, and Fairport Convention.
Well, I was 19 when I came to town. They call it the summer of love.
This is Brian Kelso Crow inviting you to join me for covering Richard Thompson on the next Celtic Connections.
Listen to Celtic Connections this Sunday beginning at 3 p.m. on KUAF.
Last weekend, Kip Kibling and Stefan, Micah, and Isaac Szabo, four members of the band National Park Radio, stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio. During their visit, they played a song that is not available on their self-titled debut EP.
Okay, this song is a newer song, not on the album. It's called Rise Above.
Forget what others say. Don't focus on the pain. Let go and pray that healing will take its place. Today's another day. Just put the past away. Some men fall, but I think you'll be okay. It's not your fault. We all have our different ways. And we're broken by the ones we love the most. But there's more to do, more than we'll ever know. Can you see? Just look into my eyes. Can you feel my heartbeat? I'm alive. I will not lie down until I die. I will rise above who knows how high. The most. But there's more to do, more than we'll ever know. Can you see? Just look into my eyes. Can you feel my heartbeat? I'm alive. I will not. The ones we love the most. There's more to do, more than we'll ever know. Can you see? Just look into my eyes. Can you feel my heartbeat? I'm alive. I will not lie down until I die. I will rise above who knows how high.
That was National Park Radio inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio.
Walton Art Center presents And a Union Friday night as part of the 10x10 Art Series. These musicians will travel across the globe to perform traditional folk music from Inner Mongolia, including throat singing and unusual instruments. Tickets and more information are available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600.
The Little Craft Show is currently seeking applicants for its 2013 show on December 7th at the Fayetteville Town Center. The Little Craft Show is a holiday market that caters to hand-selected independent artisans and crafters from Northwest Arkansas and surrounding states. I went last year. It was really cute and a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun.
Yeah. All interested participants must submit an application form and photos or links of their work by September 30th, which is tomorrow. More information is available at thelittlecraftshow.com.
The Center for Ethics and Journalism within the Lemke Department at the University of Arkansas will host a public lecture October 9th, beginning at 7, at the Hillside Auditorium on campus. If you're not familiar, that is a newer building that's along Dixon Street on the University of Arkansas campus. Professors Gerald Jordan and Patsy Watkins will be discussing current issues in journalism with the visiting professor of ethics, veteran journalist and renowned author Gene Foreman. If you'd like more information about this event on October 9th, you can go to journalism.uark.edu.
And another journalism program, but this one of a very different nature.
Miles apart.
Right. The annual Northwest Arkansas Gridiron Show, Truth, Justice, and the Gridiron Way, is set for October 4th and 5th at 7:30 p.m. The annual spoof of local, state, and national news events, written and performed by local journalists, will be performed at the Rogers Little Theater. For tickets and more information, visit nwagridiron.com.
Two KUAF people will be involved.
Antoinette Grajeda.
She'll be on stage, as will
Zeke Martin.
His first ever Gridiron, I believe.
How exciting for him.
That's right. It is the final Sunday of September. Speaking of Antoinette Grajeda, she will be hosting an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon.
She will.
Included on tomorrow's program, my conversation with Denny Casto about his new book, Arkansas Late in the Civil War. And it's about many of the battles and skirmishes and guerrilla warfare that took place in central and southern Arkansas.
So not the ones that we're familiar with.
Right. Not Prairie Grove, not Pea Ridge. And that's kind of why I wanted to talk to him, because up here, we know very much about those. Mm-hmm. But these are including some battles that took place on the White River with warships.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He said, despite the fact that it was very remote and tough terrain, modern warfare was happening in central and past for modern warfare then in central and southern Arkansas. That conversation and much more tomorrow at noon with Antoinette on Daily Ozarks at Large.
All right.
Ozarks, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Gentry.
Gentry Petting Zoo.
Sure.
I mean, that's the reason why I go to Gentry. All they actually have a really cute downtown square, too.
They do. Yeah. I like Gentry a lot.
Okay. Ozarks at Large, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Until then, wait.
Until sometime.
Until someday. Thanks for listening and have a good Sunday.